we got a game.
Yeah, we've got games the next 2 days.
Oh yeah, of course it's the half term treat, isn't it? That's how they're advertising the Wigan.
Yeah, on Pancake Day though. So
why is there always a home game on Pancake Day? It's really annoying.
I just want to sit at home and eat pancakes. Like generally, like most games, yeah, to be fair. Not
most
just
days.
Yeah.
Is Pancake Race gonna be the half time entertainment?
I hope so.
Probably.
I hope so. Or, you know, juggling lemons or doing something else with lemons. Can I just say as well, like, Lawrence Vigouroux ended up going to the Premier League, didn't he? He signed. I mean, he's not. Yeah, he's not actually playing any football, I don't think, but he signed for a Premier League club. I do not begrudge him that, because there is not a single footballer who doesn't play for Oxford United that has given me as much joy and excitement and laughter as Lawrence Vigouroux has. How many times has he? Is it twice he's been sent off against us?
In the same season. In the same season. Yeah.
I mean, to be fair to him, one of those red cards was absolutely not a red card in any way, shape, or form.
Well, no, because he had it rescinded.
He did have it rescinded. It was an absolutely horrendous decision, but even funnier as a result of it.
I remember a Swindon fan replying to when they said that it had been rescinded. Swindon fan replied saying, good, there's never been a red card in the first place. Like, yeah, that's the point.
Do you understand how this works?
But my other favourite thing about Lawrence Vigouroux was he was fined by Swindon, I think, for being late for training or not turning up for training, and they fined him like 500 quid and he paid it all in 2p's.
He's at Burnley. So he's obviously third choice keeper.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say he must be reasonably far down the pecking order.
Yes. There's a mindset within Premier League, goalkeepers in particular. There's a few of them have kind of stayed at clubs for years, probably earning a very good wage, not playing any football and just being in the goalkeeping department.
Yes, Scott Carson's.
Yeah, he was the classic
third choice at Man City. I think he still is there.
Is he?
Champions League, he was on the pitch, wasn't he, at the end of last season?
Talking about former Swindon goalkeepers in the Premier League, Wes Fodringham is playing first-team football for Sheffield United, and he was the goalkeeper for Swindon in the game that Beno got sent off. So the 2-1, the 2-0 win, I can't remember which. Anyway, but yeah, he was in goal for Swindon that game and had an absolute nightmare. He actually faced Chris Wilder's team and is now playing for Chris Wilder in the Premier League.
Ah.
Again, fair play to him. Because he was rubbish in that game. That's brilliant.
I've got to say, I didn't have Swindon goalkeepers currently playing in the Premier League as an episode.
We can do that, though.
Well, at least they can look sort of more legitimately say they've got a Premier League goalkeeper, because clinging on to Emiliano Martinez that we do is a bit tenuous, to say the least, isn't it?
He's entertaining, isn't he? But he's
that said.
That's what a goalie should be, though, isn't it?
Well, true.
Entertaining, but a knob.
So we're going to talk about, funnily enough, there's kind of a bit of a segue in from the last podcast, and not to to totally shy away from topical content.
Topical content. Content.
TM Johnny Biscuits. But when we were looking at players from the noughties and we were sort of thinking about talking through our record ever transfers, our signings, but out of the top 50, 11 of those players were signed during that decade. And I just couldn't really understand why. Is it because we were just more honest about our dealings and what people were costing? Or is it just we were just being very generous in those times?
What was quite remarkable about that point as well is that a bunch of them were when we were in the conference. And appreciate, obviously, you know, money in football has increased over time. So it's natural that every subsequent year, because the amount of money swashing around in football, you would expect to get more and more, you know, your most expensive signings to be your most recent ones, if that makes sense. But yeah, but it is still noteworthy, A, how many old players are on this list, but also, yeah, as you say, Rich, how many from a period when we were dreadful, and also, yeah, playing at a much lower level as well, which is quite striking.
I think one of the factors related to that is that Firoz Kassam has obviously been demonised for various things over the years, but he did have a habit of every now and then splurging on players in order to try and blast his way to success. I think what he didn't realise is that you can't just bring in Paul Moody for, I can't remember what it was, £150,000 or something, and then that fixes it. And before that, there was Andy Scott and, was it Barry Quinn?
No, it was Rob Quinn.
Rob Quinn, that's right. You know, which was a panic buy. And at the time, Andy Scott was top scorer in the division. And again, it didn't work. But I think that was a big factor, is that Kassam did throw money at the club from time to time, but just not in that kind of consistent club-building way. It was just panic buys.
He was quite happy to chuck a load of money at an over-the-hill striker, but wasn't happy to spend money on allowing the players to have squash at away games.
I was literally going to mention squash at training. That seems to be the kind of pivot around the success and failure of Firoz Kassam, was his investment in Kiora.
Isn't it funny how though, like, chairmen end up, if they've got some personality, I guess, end up with a thing. So Firoz Kassam, I mean, apart from all of the other things that he did to the club, you know, which is keep it on its knees financially for the best part of 20 years, one of the most memorable things is the orange squash thing. And then Daryl Eales has got his hot dogs at Carlisle, hasn't he? And I just quite like that. It'd be interesting to see what Grant Ferguson's...
Well, we're simple people.
We are.
We know what's important to us.
Food. So what do we want to do? Do we want to kind of go through the list from the top, from the bottom? How do we?
Well, I guess the link into topical content. I'm trying to say that, and so I'm going to get a sound effect out of it, is that probably Will Goodwin is in the top five our all-time signings, given that I think we know accurately the top two or three, and given that I'm pretty sure Elliot Moore features in that top five as well. So yeah, he's the kind of catalyst for this conversation, because he's even though officially the transfer fee is undisclosed, we've heard what figures between £400,000 and £500,000.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because he's obviously come to create depth in our squad, to provide support to Mark Harris, not just necessarily on the pitch support, but, you know, just so Mark Harris isn't having to play every single game. But it's interesting because obviously the price tag brings expectation. At the moment, he's coming in and he's going to try and dislodge a player whose supporters really like anyway, because he puts a lot of effort in and is now suddenly scoring every single game. It might actually be a while before we even see that much of Goodwin.
Although Des did say in an interview that he's not adverse to putting Harris out wide and playing them together.
I don't think Harris is adverse to that either, because this is the only season he's ever played as a number nine up front on his own. At Cardiff, he was always out wide or second striker or number 10, whatever we want to call it. So I think he'd be quite happy to play on the right-hand side of a front three. But then he's up against competition from Owen Dale, returning Josh Murphy, Tyler Bury.
Also, there's an outdated view on how squads work amongst the fans. Are always about 10, 15 years behind what's actually going on the pitch. So, you know, the idea of a star striker that plays every game and scores masses of goals, I think, is completely outdated. That Harris and Goodwin couldn't possibly play together because they're both star strikers. I think that's just not how these things work. There was something on Twitter not long ago about the number of minutes that players have played this season, and the idea that you get ever-presents who play for 46 games a year is also completely outdated. You know, you need players to cover each other, and it's not necessarily a kind of... I wonder if the mindset of a player is different to how it used to be, whereas they want to play every week, but nowadays they're a bit more accepting that they'll come and go a little bit. And that's not such a big issue, that if they miss a game that they'll play the next one or whatever.
And I think particularly when we are in a situation when we're playing lots of Tuesdays, just for the sake of the quality of the output of our players, even if they're actually capable of making it through 90 minutes twice a week, they're gonna be worse for it. And I think, I mean, I genuinely think that's been an issue with McGwain. He's looked knackered to me in the last kind of however long, yeah. And his performances have been much worse as a result of it.
I think that players these days as well accept that it's a more of a squad game these days. I don't think. You know, squads a lot bigger than they used to be, and I do think that they probably expect not to be playing every single match.
Right, so let's get back to the list then, shall we? So, you say we've got Will Goodwin is up there in the top five of our most expensive footballers that we've signed up. I'm going to start at the top. Why not? Top of the list is Marvin Johnson. I do remember his signing being, sorry, what's the number on him as well? It's, hang on. Yeah, £650,000. And I do remember it being quite widely reported that, God, we've absolutely gone to town, get his name. But talking about kind of levels of expectation, because I mean, I liked him. I thought he was great. I'm not sure we got he's our most expensive player worth of contribution from him. But
no, he didn't stand out in that team at all, did he? A reasonably forgettable player, I would say. I mean, maybe that's more of a reflection of the team that we had rather than him. But like you say, he didn't give off the vibe of being a big, expensive player. I think he was injured a bit as well, though, to be fair. And also, we never really found a position for him.
No.
Because he was playing left back, left wing back, left wing. He was sort of all over the place, really, which maybe didn't help. But he's a good player, but
I think also modern players and the way it works, obviously you buy a player with thought to sell them. And so he was with us so fleetingly that you never really got to know him. You know, he was just he was in and then he was gone. It was a season, wasn't it, in the end that he lasted. I mean, I thought when he was on his game, he was superb. Yeah. The biggest disappointment was the Checker Trade final. I thought he was made for Wembley and he just didn't perform at all. And it was just awful because the pitch is so big and such an expansive space for him to kind of exploit with his pace and stuff. And he just never did it. And so that was a shame. But I think a few of these more recent signings, not necessarily the record signings, but the signings generally, players just kind of fly through the squad nowadays and just disappear. And you never really kind of build any kind of relationship with them.
We did ultimately make a reasonable profit on him. It was Borough he went to after he left us, didn't he? Does anybody got to hand how much we sold him for, if that was ever disclosed? But it's just as an aside, because it'll obviously come up in this conversation. Undisclosed fees should be against the law. This kind of stuff is our soap opera stuff. You know, it's the stuff that you talk about over the garden fence. We want to gossip about, oh, isn't he expensive? and I think it's unfair that they don't let us have that. I
do live next door to Monty Python women.
So, second on the list, Dean Windass for £475,000. Although we reckon adjusted for inflation, that was £884,000. So nearly £1 million there for Dean Windass.
And from what I've heard, adjusted for what we actually paid, £0.
Yeah, it was utterly mad. We signed him from Aberdeen on some sort of financing agreement, didn't pay a penny. We were broke. We just announced that we were broke as well, I think, and then signed him, and that didn't make any sense. He had a great season while we were having a terrible season, and then he went to Bradford. He didn't last a year.
No, it was that was when it was still just sort of transfer deadline day in March, wasn't it? And I think that was when he left. He was a great player. I kind of have a bit of a grudge about Dean Windass, which is unfair, as most of my grudges are. But I feel like him leaving, that was the start of our decline, because that season we got relegated. We had a lot of nil-nils, where we lost by the odd goal after he'd gone, and we only got relegated by 3 points. And I always felt like if he'd have just waited until the summer, we probably would have stayed up. Everything would have been different.
What a bastard.
I hate.
So who's next? Well, possibly Will Goodwin. As I think we said, Elliot Moore came for an undisclosed fee, but I distinctly remember it being talked at the time about being our record signing, which would have been like having to pay getting on for £1 million for him, I suppose. Probably we'll never know, but I think he probably is in the top five, from what I understand. So the point being that I think Elliot Moore probably should be in that top three or four, but officially Conan Greenall, missed by Transfer Market, but not by Wikipedia. So he came in 88 from Gillingham for £235,000, which in today's money is £626,000.
So the thing about Greenall was we were going down from the first division. Maxwell had given up on financing the club, was much more interested in Derby. For no obvious reason, we signed Colin Green, or as you say, from Gillingham. It was like us nowadays spending £1.5 million on Carl Pettinger. He was such an unremarkable player.
That you've forgotten his name.
Pettifer, yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, there you go. Carl Pettifer.
Well, no further questions.
If it was about spending money in order to try and save the season and stay in the First Division, Colin Greenaw isn't the player that you do it with. I don't know why they did it. It was just it makes no sense at all. But yeah, for a long time, he was our...
Is it possible that it was sort of a panic buy? Because, I mean, now we kind of know what the rumours are about players that we've tried to sign. We know who's turned us down. And then suddenly we get someone in last minute. Whereas back then, we didn't have that with social media. It might be that a lot of other players turned us down and Colin Greenaw was the only one who wanted to come.
Yeah, but could well have been. Yeah, Greenaw actually says yes, and they go, what?
So, yeah, I know it's going to move on to the next one, David Bardsley from Watford for 265.
I was going to ask you two about David Bardsley, because, again, just a little bit before my time.
Got to ask the old people.
Only a little bit. Like, he left the season I started going, but he didn't really play. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because he's probably one of the only Oxford players who's gone on and played in the Premier League. He got a couple of England caps. Yeah, he's just never mentioned. Nobody, you never see anybody sort of put David Bardsley in their best 11. And he's not sort of ever mentioned as an Oxford legend or anything. I just find it's an interesting... And I don't know if that's kind of because he was sandwiched between David Langan and Les Robinson, who obviously are very much Oxford legends, and he just gets a little bit forgotten. If you've got, you know, people who pick players from the 80s for their best team, they'd go for Langan, or if they've got the 90s, they go for Les Robinson. And he's just kind of in that sort of no man's land between those two. But I mean, or is it just that he wasn't particularly impressive for us?
No, I think you've got it bang on. He was in between two legends and playing in a failing team. And we were spoiled at the time because we were playing in the First Division. So it wasn't a terrible team, but it was getting terrible results. So he's always going to get labelled as part of that team. He wore the kit, the yellow and white striped, which is a relegation kit. You know, he's just got it all. He's got bad vibes all around him. But I mean, he was a great player. He should be much higher up the list of great players that we had.
He isn't going to come anywhere near the cult heroes that played in that position.
Talking of cult heroes, we'll move on to the next one. Somebody who absolutely was not a cult hero in any way, shape or form. I've been really, really mean about that. Yeah. Anyway, Kane Hemmings, which is a surprise to see him up there on our most expensive transfers ever. But apparently £250,000 we paid for Kane Hemmings. So maybe a little bit more than 300 grand in today's money, because it wasn't that long ago, I suppose. I did a thing, because he scored a few goals, didn't he? I remember trying to process why I didn't think he was very good, even though he did score some goals. And I looked at where he was scoring all of his goals. The vast majority of his goals were either the fifth goal in a 5-0 win or a consolation goal in a 4-1 defeat. He didn't actually earn us a single point in any of his games through his goals. So it was just this amazing ability to score completely meaningless goals.
He'd had a storming season at Dundee. I think that's probably why his fee was so high. But you're absolutely right. It wasn't because he scored 16 goals or something like that season. They were all completely meaningless. Incredible.
number six on our list, who says £275,000 reported transfer fee from Swansea, and that's Andy Melville.
Excellent player.
He was great. I was in Manchester at that time, being a student in the middle of the Manchester years, so my memory's a bit sketchy.
He was kind of unspectacular, wasn't he? But very much missed when he left, I think. One of those players who... Maybe that's a bit unfair in his time here, but maybe he was slightly underappreciated just how good he was.
He was so spoilt by going up to the First Division. Certainly the early 90s, the team I don't know, we expected them to fly up the division.
Yeah, because we were punting above our weight in the 80s, really, weren't we, in the top division. But we had a lot of good players in the early 90s, I think, when you look back. And yeah, Melville was definitely one of the best ones.
Should we just go out and pick out some notable names? Who wants to start?
Can I start with, because I've done a bit of research into John Dernan. So John Dernan's record is quite extraordinary. Now, bear with me, because this might go on a while. February 1989, he joined Oxford United. November 1989, he was dropped by Brian Horton after being arrested on a drink driving offence. December 1989, he was convicted of drink driving, driving while disqualified and without insurance. He was fined £850 and banned for 12 months. He was the fifth Oxford player to be convicted of drink driving in 3 years. January 1990, Brian Horton put him on the transfer list. March 1990, fined £300 and ordered to pay compensation for headbutting a former Oxford physio, Rob Hayden, in a nightclub. November 1990, due in court for GBH and ABH, fined £1,000 plus £450 compensation for headbutting two teenagers at the Palace nightclub in Oxford. He'd had 8 pints of lager, which I thought was a nice detail in the news story. September 1992, convicted of speeding, although escaped a ban despite being caught speeding just hours before he was due in court. July 1993, signed for Portsmouth. December 1993, attacked a Fiorentina player after an Anglo-Italian Cup game. He'd had an altercation at the game and then saw the players in the hotel afterwards and ran at them with a kitchen knife. The next morning, he bumped into the players in the hotel lift and headbutted one of them. August 1994, an arrest warrant was issued when he failed to turn up to court on 5 occasions for a speeding offence. January 1996, he was banned for 3 years after being caught drink driving in Whitney. In 1999, he dislocated his shoulder when he turned over a golf buggy. And then there's a bit of a gap, but April 2015, he was in court after kicking down his girlfriend's front door. He returned the next day searching for, in quotes, other men. He throttled his girlfriend with her dressing gown after finding a picture of a woman that looked like her on a dating site. The woman in the picture had a tattoo and his girlfriend didn't. He received a suspended sentence. In 2015, he was also convicted of common assault for headbutting a man for riding too close to him, and he got a suspended sentence. June 2019, he was convicted of a racist attack on an OAP at a drive-through McDonald's. He bought a breakfast from McDonald's and parked nearby. The OAP drove past, and he punched him in the face. The incident happened 6 days after he'd thrown a coffee cup at a cyclist and claimed to be a police officer. In mitigation, he said he'd just discovered his wife had been cheating on him. He was convicted of common assault and impersonating a police officer. How does he have the time to play football?
Ooh, Johnny Lager. We loved him, though, didn't we?
It's all good fun.
We just called him Johnny Lager.
Top bounce.
All of that for £225,000. What a bargain.
But the club invited him back. I don't know if you remember this, a few years ago. They were trying to do this thing where they were inviting former players back to train with the current team. And the two players that they invited back on one occasion was John Dernan and Mark Wright. I did point out to the club that the kick racism out of football campaign seems slightly meek when they're bringing these two players back.
But I'm sure everybody wants to talk about Simo, right?
Oh, I love Simo.
I'm sure one person does.
He's my hero, my absolute hero. He was, because when I started going in 89, and he was obviously our best player. Just such a joy to watch. And I watched the highlights of that season a little while ago on YouTube, and he's just evolved in everything. He's just everything seems to come from Simo. When he left, when he signed for Derby, that was the first time football made me cry. I was devastated. I remember going to my room. I was lying in my room with the lights off, just in floods of tears. I was like, how could this happen? Yeah, he's my hero.
To be fair, you weren't far off that when Chris Maguire left.
No, that's true. No, I left the lights on, though. But, I mean, you know, he was just a typical old-fashioned winger, wasn't he? He was, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on pace now, but he wasn't pacey, but he was so skillful. And scored a lot of goals as well for a winger, didn't he? I wrote to him after he left as well.
You bastard!
I wrote to him saying...
How could you do this to me?
I wrote to him just sort of saying that he was my favourite player at the club when he was there and everything. And he wrote me the loveliest letter back. Really lovely letter. And he sent me a signed photo as well in his Derby kit. But, you know. But that's fine. I just cut the head out and put it on his old ox. yeah, bargain, that one. That's got to be the best value, hasn't it? How much would we pay for him?
200,000.
Oh, that's quite a lot, actually, isn't it? We know he sold him for about 500,000, though, didn't we?
Speaking of players who were written to after they left, I remember I'd said this in the Augsburger podcast of the old school one, but I wrote to Martin Gray when he left, and he's on this list, 23rd, having paid six figures for him, apparently 100,000. Talking about not knowing what you've got till it's gone, I think he's a classic example of that. And in fact, the fans were singing his name by the time he left. But yeah, my abiding memories of him were just having to fight through everything to be recognised as a really decent defensive midfielder. He scored the odd goal as well. Yeah, when he left, I wrote to him. He didn't write back, but he did then send me a Christmas card, that's a shame I can't find. And in the Christmas card, he cut out a picture of him from the local paper, which showed him squeezing the balls of an opposing player, like, you know, the Vinnie Jones Gascoigne photograph.
Yeah,
him doing that to a player caught on camera, and he cut it out and put it in the Christmas card to me. How lovely is that?
What did you say in your letter?
Yeah, that's the mystery, isn't it?
I was going to say I'm slightly disappointed that we've gone past Brian Wilstermann, who's in our top 10.
Yeah, I was surprised he was quite high as well. But I do wonder this about some players, and there's someone else we mentioned earlier, and I can't remember who it was. I don't have particularly good memories of Brian Wilstermann, but we did sign him to replace Matt Elliott, and that is a big pair of boots to fill, isn't it? And I do wonder if some of these players probably aren't as bad as we remember. It's just that, you know, we're looking at the player they've replaced. You're not going to replace Matt Elliott easily, are you?
It's called the David Bardsley effect, isn't it?
Yes.
I think there was a tipping point, wasn't there? Because we had Elliott and Gilchrist, and then we had Darren Peirce as the sort of backup, and he was fantastic as well. Elliott moves on, Peirce moves in, and so into the gap comes Wilstermann. It changed the dynamic, this idea that we had ongoing procession of centre-backs, which actually probably goes on till Andy Melville, and even through to Shotton and Briggs, you know, and then Brian Wilstermann came around, and then you realise you're in a bit of trouble. Seems such a lovely bloke.
Yeah.
From another country, that was quite exciting as well.
Yeah, it was quite exotic signing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All the way from Holland, exotic Holland.
I can't remember, did he play for Ajax? I mean, everybody who's Dutch has played for Ajax. It's like national service, isn't it? Yeah.
Just on the good value thing as well, I'm just going to chuck in Cameron Brannigan.
Mm.
We spoke on the last episode about people who write their name into Oxford United folklore through being one with the club. And we've actually mentioned a few players like that. I mean, obviously, Joey and Beano, obviously, as we mentioned last week. But Cameron Brannigan is steadily and slowly, as long as he sticks around, he has his ups and downs in form. But, you know, his effort, particularly at the moment, is fantastic. And, you know, I think he's very expensive on a wage, as far as we can tell. But I think he's the amount of effort and the amount of games and the goals and the important goals and in the hard work that we've had out of him for his transfer already paid for itself. As far as I'm concerned, I think he's.
What about Christaps Grebis?
Is he on the list?
He's on the list.
Oh my god, he was bad.
I mean, was he though?
I have no idea.
I mean, he was well dressed. Remember that? Because the only picture of him to do with Oxford United, he's on the pitch with his coat and his scarf. There's no pictures of him in a kit, I don't think.
Amazing.
But he was another one we were quite excited about, I think.
Well, he played in the Champions League, hadn't he?
Oh,
for like Metalurgs or...
I was going to say anyone can play in the Champions League these days. They allow the top 10 teams from any division in there.
He played four times for us, apparently.
Did he? Well, there we go. It depends on the manager.
It's one of those players, those players who have an amazing time at one club, try other things, end up back in the same place. So he spent 4 years with Metalurgs, scored 45 times, played four times for us, 11 times for the team we sold them to, Ventspils, but then went back to Metalurgs and scored 55 goals in 75 games. Not to be sniffed at, is it?
Well, he's a Pat Hoban, isn't he? Pat Hoban is like a goal-scoring legend in the League of Ireland.
I think that's harsh on Pat Hoban. I do. He was all right.
I mean, he wasn't very good.
It wasn't Grebis bad.
He wasn't Grebis bad. He brought a lot of players over from Ireland, haven't we? And they've not all worked out. And I think he was just one of the ones that hasn't worked out. But it's worth doing those because for every one that hasn't worked out, three have worked out.
I just read the article from when we signed Grebis. Jim Smith admits he's taken a dip into the unknown by capturing Latvian striker Kristap Grebis, but it's a signing that will excite Oxford fans. Yeah, we've had a few players that have moved on very quickly over the last few years, haven't we? Like Rob Atkinson and Luke McNally. Yeah, Rob Dickey. Well, maybe he was here a little longer, but...
That particular sequence, it was mad, wasn't it? Dickey was with us 2 years, was he? Rob Atkinson 1 year, Luke McNally effectively half a season.
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy how quickly these players are get picked up.
Right, I think if we got everything out of this that we think we can...
I think so.
Got any more Kristaps Grebis content, anybody? No.
Is there any more? So who do you think on that list is the best value? Joey's got to be the best bit of business ever, hasn't it? To sell him for $1 million and then a year back, buy him back for 150.
Yeah, that was pretty storming business. I mean, he was fairly damaged when he did come back, but eventually he kind of turned it round. But
yeah, he did, yeah. Yeah, it took him a few months to settle back in, didn't it? But
I thought, I think his first game was back against Stockport. And I thought the manor would be full and that there would be people lining the streets because Beecham was back. And then I realised that that's just inside my head. And I expected him also to kind of absolutely tear the place to pieces. And of course, he was a little bit, he was a bit shell-shocked, I think, by what had happened.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
But then the great redemption story of his goal against Swindon at the end of that season and promotion and everything that came after it.
Yeah,
overall, superb bit of business.
If there isn't something honouring him at the new ground, I think it'll be a...
You've got a really good idea, haven't you?
Well, yeah. So my idea was statue of him in the pose of the goal against Blackpool from that photograph. So that pose with him with the ball on the end of his toe, and then have that positioned exactly as far away from the stadium as he was from the London Road when he took that shot. And then have the old London Road signs on the stadium as well.
Which the club now own, don't they?
Which the club now own, yeah. Because they bought them off Nick, didn't they?
Mm.
You've got to throw that into the mix. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I think I might have mentioned it to the club, but yeah, I will. I think I put it into when they did the consultation, but I will try and mention it again.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing that gets forgotten, and then that sounds like a brilliant idea.
Because, I mean, he is about the only player you can think of who would be worthy of a statue.
Yeah.
Maybe Chris Maguire with his seven pose. I think I'd go for that.
I don't want him with the seven pose. I want him with doing the eyes.
We should have like a row of Chris Maguire statues. One like that.
I want a Chris Maguire statue bearing down on a Laurence Vigouroux statue.
Yeah.
All outside the away end.
Yeah.